go ahead and get started. This is What Is Left to the Imagination. If you're not here for What Is Left to the Imagination, you're in the wrong place. We're going to go ahead and let the panelists introduce themselves. I think we'll start down at this end.
Hello, my name is Gregory Wilson. I'm an associate professor of English at St. John's in New York City, where I teach courses in fantasy fiction, among others. And my first novel, which is a work of epic fantasy, came out last year from Gale Cengage. My next work is being shopped by two publishers as we speak. And I'm also co-editing an anthology on speculative fiction and politics with a lot of people who are here, including Jill Haldeman and people like that. And that also is closing in on a publisher as well.
Lawrence C. Connolly. Stories have been in fantasy and science fiction, Cemetery Dance, and Twilight Zone. Latest novel is Vipers, and latest collection is This Way to Egress from Ashtree Press. Cover artist is World Fantasy.
I'm Martha Wells, and I've been writing fantasy since 1993, and probably my best-known novel is The Death of the Necromancer, which was a Nebula nominee in 1998, and I have a new book coming out next March.
The name of it is.
Oh, and the name of it is The Cloud Roads, and it'll be out in March of next year.
My name is Delia Sherman, and I've written a few novels and a lot of short stories. My latest novel is Changeling, which is for younger readers, and The Magic Year of the Mermaid Queen, and I write fantasy.
My name is Madeline Robbins. I will pretty much write whatever I think of and then try to figure out what to do with it later. The author of a couple of alternate Regency mystery series books, Word of Honor and Deadly Treason. I'm here finishing a third in that series. And I also, and this is in fact germane to this conversation, used to edit comic books. I'll get back to that.
Okay, I wanted to get started. I think this is kind of an open-ended topic in a lot of ways. I think everybody's going to have a different take on exactly what it means. But I want to give my take first, because then if everybody else has better takes, then you won't remember mine. I interpreted it as fantasy that leaving boundaries open, because the type of fantasy I like is the kind where it's not everything is completely described. The world feels very open-ended, and like the story may be taking place in a small part of it, but there are just limitless expanses there still to be filled in. And that's kind of my take on it. And let's go ahead. We'll start with Madeline this time, and let you talk about your take on what the title of the panel is. I keep forgetting. So what leaving fantasy is the art of leaving things out.
I said I mentioned this when I was editing comic books. I had a couple of artists who would relentlessly draw every single thing that was supposed to be happening. And I finally got the conference room one day, and I showed them the barn dance scene from Witness, where nothing happens and everything happens. It's one of the most erotically charged scenes I've ever seen, and they dance for about 30 seconds to the tune of Don't Know Much About History. And three of the four guys got it, and one of them sailed right over his head. There is a whole class of experience where I know what my buttons are, but I don't know what your buttons are. And if I lead you up to the point where you know you can supply your own scary thing or sexy thing or whatever, you're going to supply the thing that pushes your buttons because you know what they are. And if a writer who does that skillfully enough will do it in such a way that you don't notice, that the reader doesn't notice that they've been given, that somebody's handed them the steering wheel and said, okay, you take it from here.
The kind of fantasy that I write and the kind of fantasy that I am the most interested in is mythic, fairy tale, folklore-oriented fantasy. And quite a lot of that, Patricia McKillop writes it, it has to do with the numinous, a sense of mystery, a sense of beauty and something that is beyond and something that is ineffable and under and kind of beyond the grasp of human, of mere humans. And therefore, I think that the most successful fantasy of that kind is is a great deal is left to the imagination, where the magic is not explained, where there are creatures that are magical, they don't do magic. And I find that sense of mystery, when it is over-explained to me, it's like watching all of the how this movie was made reels and not watching the movie. I would rather have the mystery be unexplained. And so I think that is, for me, that a great deal needs to be left to the imagination. But that doesn't mean that it can't make emotional sense. It has to make emotional sense, or else nobody will understand it.
Yeah, I think that's very true. The comment about the movie, my husband likes to watch the director's commentary, and there's some movies where I think it's kind of ruined for me at that point, because, like Sleepy Hollow is an example. There's a scene in Sleepy Hollow where it's a pretty horrible scene where the monster breaks into the cabin and he kills the family. And there's a little boy hiding under the wooden floor. And there's a long stretch where you think the kid's going to escape, and then no, he finds him and kills him. And it was one of the most effective scenes in the movie, because killing children, particularly very young children, is sort of still a little bit of a taboo, and it's almost making a very deliberate statement. It's not something you sort of throw away. And when the director described that scene, he's like, yeah, I don't know why I did that. And it's like, because it gave the feel that anything could happen in this movie. Nobody was safe. Anyone could be killed at any time. There were no boundaries. There were no rules. It made it even more frightening. But yeah, exactly. Oh, and if y'all want to like jump in when someone else talks, we're not doing it. It's not a rigid thing. It's just because we have the microphone, and it's signal me if you want the microphone.
One thing that I tried to do with the Baynes books, Baynes and then Vipers, which came after it, is before I started work on them, is I mapped out this magic that existed in this rural town in southwestern Pennsylvania, which centers on an abandoned surface mine, and worked out the cosmic elements that are taking place in this part of the world, and cosmic elements that are beyond human understanding, but I had to map them all out so I knew how they worked. And then put some characters into motion in this world where this magic begins to manifest itself. Now, they don't know what's going on. I know. So I know what the rules are, but they don't know. So the trick in writing is to keep me from coming forward and explaining as the characters react to the strangeness that's going on around them. And so what I try to do is I try to know what's going on so that the reader says, okay, there's a symmetry here. There's something in the background that is all adding up. But I'm not with the author. I'm with the characters. And there's a lot here that I don't know. There's a lot here that is grabbing my imagination and make me try to figure out what it is. And what I tried to do with the first book is I tried to have this character named Axel who learned some things from his great-grandmother, who knew some things about Native American lore in the area. And so the first book tried to explain it with some Native American lore, and the second book's trying to explain it with Christian mythology. Because the characters, each character is coming at this strangeness from a different way. But as we'll discover in the third book, it's none of those things. And what I'm going to have to wrestle with in the third book is not to explain it, but just to keep the imagination running and have the characters come to some kind of conclusion in their lives, even though, as we know from day-to-day life, we don't understand a lot of what is going on around us. And there is no voiceover in our lives. That's what makes life fun. I think that's what makes fantasy fun, is having that imagination element where you don't know it. You kind of got to figure it out, but you've got to go on with your daily life while the craziness takes place, goes on around you. So that's what I try to think of when I am attempting to fuel the imagination in fantasy.
There are two things that came to mind for me when I thought about this. The first is, for years I have taught in my, to open up my fantasy course, Beowulf, followed by John Gardner's brilliant book, Grendel. And one of the things that's interesting about that is that most of the time I find that students react better, those of you who have read Grendel know what I mean, to Grendel than they do to Beowulf. And the reason is because it's modern, it's hip even, it has this sense of angst, which many of my students can identify with or believe that they can. And so Grendel as a character is intriguing to them. He's exasperating, he's annoying, he's irritating, but he's also somewhat like them in his own way. What I found this year for the first time, and I don't know if this is a change, it's a very small sample size of one semester, is that they didn't like him particularly this time, and the reason was because, most of them said, they had found out too much about him through Gardner's book, as they saw it, and preferred to think of him as the monstrous other that we never really recognize, right? The boogeyman that hides in the closet and that none of us ever see for real, because if we did, he wouldn't be that frightening, right? What makes the boogeyman frightening is that he stays in the closet and never comes out, but he's always there. And I found that fascinating, and I think one of the things that reflects to me is the second thing I thought about for this panel, and that is that there's a sense in which, especially when it comes to motivations in fantasy and what drives characters to react to the things that they do in the fantasy that we write and read, revealing too much of that is a dangerous thing. I saw a presentation at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, a few years back by Stephen Greenblatt, who's a famous literary critic and historian, and he was talking about Othello and Iago. And in that presentation, he suggested that there was, in Shakespeare, what he called strategic opacity, one of my favorite terms ever, this idea that although in the original version of Othello, Iago's motivations for doing what he does to Othello are extremely clear. The reason is because Othello sleeps with his wife. This isn't questioned, it's not implied, it's a fact. It happens at the beginning of the play, everybody, or the beginning of the plot, everyone knows that it happens, and that then makes Othello into a revenge tragedy moving forward from that point. What Shakespeare does, Greenblatt said, was to draw the curtain over that motive, and he actually drains the motive from Iago, so that at the end of the play, we don't know whether Othello did anything to Iago at all, except some maybe generally vague sense of envy that Iago has towards him. And at the end of the play, when Iago's treachery is revealed, he says, I never more will speak, right? And so we're left at the end of the play thinking, what? How could you do this? Why? And of course, the curtain comes down without us ever having the answer to that question. To me, to what Greenblatt said to that was that it is that which gives that play its power, the motivelessness, if you will, the purity of the evil that is reflected in Iago. And I think that in speculative fiction, the less that we tell, what Pat Rothfuss calls the art of keeping secrets, let's say, in some ways, the more that we allow the imagination that drew people to fantasy in the first place to do their work as readers. And so there's an art to it. If you don't reveal enough, then you become frustrating to the readers in another way. But understanding the line between how much and how little you will reveal and at what time, I think, becomes extremely important in giving it that kind of authority.
I think one of the great mistakes that Thomas Harris made with after the success of Silence of the Lambs was in giving Hannibal Lecter, who is this monster who was all the more frightening because he comes out of nowhere, a backstory, and he becomes Superman, you know, or the negative Superman. He's come from his version of Krypton, and the book was, I know the book was successful, they made a movie, all this stuff. I just found it completely gutted the fascination for the character.
Yeah, I agree. It's just the thing, it brings him down to our level. And it takes him from a mythic figure into just this, you know, a criminal who needs to be stopped. But has anybody ever have any other comments on?
Yeah, Hannibal. If I could say something about Hannibal, I think that excellent example. If we take a look at Thomas Harris series, and if we start with Red Dragon, right? Now that's the first one that Hannibal Lecter appears in. Am I getting these in the right order? Hannibal Lecter is creepy in that book, okay, because he's a secondary character in Red Dragon. And in many ways, that's the most successful rendering of Hannibal Lecter, in my opinion, my modest opinion. And then in the next book, Silence of the Lambs, right? All right, so now Hannibal Lecter is forefront, but he's still pretty creepy. But where it begins to fall apart, I think, is in Hannibal, where we begin to get inside of Hannibal Lecter and we see this mansion that he has in his mind where he compartmentalizes everything, and Harris is trying to make him a sympathetic character. But that book still has its moments when Hannibal Lecter bugs us out a bit, and we don't know quite what's motivating him. But I think where it really falls apart is that last book, isn't it? The most recent one. What is it? Hannibal, the Early Days or something? And that's the one. And
Hannibal, the High School Years.
And that one fell apart so much for me that I that's the one I couldn't finish. And so maybe it is a good book, but I thought that too much was being explained. I don't want to get into the mad guy's head and find out it makes sense, you know.
Go ahead. Except for when it does. I have read books, and I'm getting into mystery now, and not so much into either horror, but Ruth Rendell is better than anybody else at writing something from the point of view of a mass murderer or a psychopath. And you're reading along, and it all makes perfect sense. It all is absolutely logical if you start out from whatever theory they have of their lives that makes it okay to kill people, that makes it okay to do the horrible things that they have done. And that is extremely creepy because it's a different kind of mystery. What the mystery, what the thing that has been left out there is ordinary morality that we as a culture have decided that it is not moral to kill a bunch of people because you don't like the way they wear their hair or they're annoying. And even though you might like to, you can't do it. And these characters, there's one that she's written, and I do not remember the name, but the character is illiterate. And because they're illiterate, their level of frustration and hiding their illiteracy becomes more and more pressing. And finally, as they start to kill, you can see why it makes sense to them. And it makes absolute sense. But it's terrifying because you have been taken loose from your own sense of morality. So it depends on what you're doing with it. Sometimes if you're focusing on the motive, and it is a motive that is not going to be common to most of your readers, it will be extremely effective.
I think the best example, or at least in my opinion, in her books that does that, is A Dark Adapted Eye. And it's not from the murderer's perspective, it's a woman whose aunt committed a murder when she was a little girl. And it's this woman, as she grows up, and there's this whole void in the family of, and it's her experience of trying to figure out why she did it. And she never really does completely. She comes to a lot of different theories. And it's an interesting exploration in already knowing exactly what happened and who the murderer is, she knows all the hard details, but she has absolutely no idea of the emotional occurrence that caused this to happen.
Yeah, I wonder a little bit, and I think both of those are excellent points about this. I think that's true. Although I would point out that even in those cases, we at least begin with a not understanding what it is that is their motive, and sort of it's the gradual revelation, I guess, of the mystery that happens. Whereas in a lot of these other books that don't function, it's partly because almost at the very beginning, the reason was because he had a horrible childhood, and then you've lost really what gave you that interest in the character in the first place. And I wonder if there isn't a little bit of almost a fear as writers of allowing some of that mystery, even confusion, to rest in the readers for too long. I have a friend who accuses me of being only comfortable with clarity. And I think he's right about that. I think there's times when I'm very uncomfortable with confusion. I'm a teacher, so I don't, no one likes the uncomfortable silence when you've asked a question and people are giving you the weird tilted head look that, you have to fight to sort of jump in. Well, what I mean is, and if I start explaining to them what I mean by what I just asked, then I haven't done my job, right? Then I simply become, a mobile teleprompter for them. I'm not in any way someone who's allowing them to come to these conclusions for themselves. And as writers, I wonder whether there isn't sometimes an inclination to sort of live too much in clarity. For example, to use an example from popular culture and film, how many people felt that the addition of the midichlorians improved our knowledge of the Force? honestly. I mean, the reason that we were so, at least I was, so stunned by the concept of the Force was this idea that this little creature could lift an X-Wing out of the swamp in Dagobah and lift it across this enormous thing, and Luke staring at him, stunned, and going, I can't believe it, and he says, that is why you fail, and that's amazing. And then it turns out the only reason is because, you know, he had a very good day with his DNA, and, you know, his midichlorian count, I mean, absurd. And what it does is...
It destroys
the mythic element, and it makes us feel then that it reduces it, it almost makes it more petty. And I think since we deal in the land of wonder, that is what all of these things that we do are, whether it's in fantasy or science fiction, why then would we take out the wonder that made it so interesting to us?
Yeah. There is a fairly terrible movie called Young Sherlock Holmes that insisted on giving you an origin for every single tick of Conan Doyle's. And if they just leave the deerstalker out, or don't give him the pipe, or something, it would have been so much more satisfying. Yeah. But no, they had to do it. It's like a checklist. I did want to say that some of the books that I find most interesting and most appealing are the ones where I'm never really sure if the floor is quite on the level where I think it is. There's a wonderful book that may or may not be fantasy by Marge Piercy called Woman on the Edge of Time. And by the time you finish this book, either this woman is psychotic and you are seeing her through a number of kind of odd hallucinatory episodes, or she is having a genuinely fantastic experience. She's essentially shuttling back and forth between the present and the future. And she does some really horrific things if you believe she's psychotic. If you believe that she is having this experience, then she's heroic. But Piercy leaves it there. She does not make a statement. So you have to walk away from the book and decide for yourself.
Isn't that what they do, what she does in Justine
Larbalastier.
Okay. She has a book called Liar. It's a young adult that's been really critically acclaimed, and that's one of the things she does in that, is you don't know. The main character admits at the beginning that she's a compulsive liar, I believe, and so you don't know what's really happening to her, and that it's a really classic, unreliable narrator, just something else.
Yeah, I think, I'm just thinking as I'm hearing some of these comments that it's the details, of what we see and hear and experience with our senses that are manifestations of the magic, or manifestations of the fantastic element. We can't perceive the fantastic element in its true essence. We can only perceive it through our five senses. So getting the details in the story as believable as possible, having that X-Wing lift out of the swamp, and having, you know, the water and the mud dripping off of it, and you know, having these strange things happening in a convincing way, I think is the best way to introduce fantastic details. I was thinking, as we're talking, of works that have really done that for me, really worked for me. I think that Gene Wolfe consistently does that. Will be able to create this strange world with lots of believable detail, and then not explain the fantastic behind it, but just let us see the fantastic through our senses. And you're referencing Shakespeare. I think Shakespeare, does this. This is why we remember Shakespeare, and we don't remember other people of his era. You know, George Whetstone. We don't read him because he explained everything. But Shakespeare, you know, the rest is silence. You know, after the life in the chaos of life, comes to its close, the rest is silence. The mystery is not explained, and that's why hundreds of years later, we're still talking about Hamlet. Now, one last thing, and I don't want to hog the mic, but one last thing I'm thinking about, something like Hamlet. The reason it works so well is because all the details make sense, make dramatic sense as we go through it, and we can really feel Hamlet's life as we're going through the story. And when it's over, we have this great sense of closure. The story is over, and it's only after we finish the story that we realize, no, wait a minute, there was something else going on in there. What if that ghost wasn't a ghost? What if that ghost was a demon? And we begin to think of the details that were brought up, the questions that were brought up in the works. And I think that when fantasy works best, it's when you do have a sense that there's closure at the end, but then the magic and the fantastic begins to resonate within you and you want to go back and look at it again. And then the second read through, you see there are a lot of other things lurking there in the background.
Yeah, because if the ghost is lying, if you think about it, if the ghost is lying, it's a completely different story. Another popular culture example, I don't know how popular it was, that I thought played with this almost to the extreme was the movie Doubt, if you ever saw that.
Oh, yeah.
And it's never been answered. It's set in the 50s, I believe, in a Catholic school, and there's a nun who believes one of the priests is molesting the boys. And you see the evidence on both sides, and you just go back and forth as it goes along. Well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, and they never tell you. And the whole point of the, I think it was originally a play, and the whole point was kind of get the audience, you know, arguing and discussing among themselves what they thought.
Well, he also plays with the reliability of each of the people.
Yeah,
because the nun
who
believes that he's molesting people really doesn't like this guy, thinks he's full of new ideas, and she is ready
to
believe.
And he's not very nice to her, yeah.
No,
and
there is no possibility, even if you found out the truth, that you'd really be satisfied with the truth because you can't trust either of them.
Yeah.
Well, I think that that part of what I'm taking away from this conversation we're having is that there's a difference between confusion and ambiguity, and there's a very sometimes there's a very thin line between them, and it really is what some people's ambiguity can be very confused by, and don't have a high tolerance for ambiguity.
Yeah.
So that popular culture. The reason that he felt like he had to put all the DNA stuff in there is because there were a lot of people saying, well, why is this? Why? It's supposed to be science fiction. It's not supposed to be fantasy. And we can get away, us fantasists can get away with a little bit more in the way of mystery and not having to explain things. But I also see a real track in fantasy, that there are a whole bunch of stuff, a lot of which is drawn on gaming, which is almost like science fiction with guys in pointy hats. And that everything is explained, and it's all ritual magic, and it's all extremely cut and dried. And there is a satisfaction to that, too, which the people who like it like very well. But that's not what I go to fantasy for. What I go to fantasy for is the numinous, is George MacDonald and the Golden Key, which is if you try to make the plot make sense, you become even more confused. If you just read the story and have an emotional response to it, then it makes perfect emotional sense. So you can plot it out emotionally, but you cannot plot it out logically, event by event. And whenever you try to pin down a detail, it kind of disappears. But once you've read the whole thing, you have this very strong sense of a very beautiful journey. And it's very ambiguous in many ways, and he never really tells you what it is he's trying to write about, but once you're finished, you know, because he was a fine stylist. But there are a lot of people who read The Golden Key and go, I don't get it. They're not wired for that sort of thing.
And since I do a lot of historical research and historical things of fantasy, there are people who want everything spelled out. I was workshopping a bit of a book set in the 1800s, and there was a line something like, they got in the barouche and drove away. And one of my readers could not get past the word barouche. What is it? What do you think it is? it's some sort of carriage. Well, that's exactly it. Move on. And no, but what kind of carriage? And if I had stopped and said a four-wheeled vehicle with yellow wheels, it would have stopped what was really an inconsequential moment. There's a tendency for people to say, okay, there are two kinds of people in the world. There are the people who are comfortable with essentially what I call foxhole reading. You stick your head up now and then and look around, okay, that's what's going on, fine. And duck down again and just let it happen. And then there are the people who have the map and want to make sure where they are on the map at all times. And I'm not really sure you can satisfy both.
And, well, I really think, I've always felt when people bring this up in workshops, is that the kind of reader who would stop at a word they don't know and it would just completely throw them out of the book and they would stop are not the kind of people who are going to pick up your fantasy novel. That the people who are reading fantasy already are into that are into the mindset and they know they're going to encounter words they don't know. We were talking about this the other day of like Dorothy Sayers and Dorothy Dunnett, who you know, put things in French and Latin and Greek and just no translation. And it's probably an older, because at that point, at the time they were writing, they're expecting everybody to know those languages. But the books are still readable. But I think when you get used to that, it's not so unusual to see like the word. I had one person stop because I used the word captain, like the captain you wear, you know, that was really popular in the 60s and was a big thing.
Jay and Peterman uses that word.
Yeah. But I know people had some comments, but I want to kind of wait till comments a little bit later. I had one more point I kind of wanted to address. I think the art of leaving things out applies really well to epic fantasy and created world fantasy and probably like Charles de Lint style contemporary fantasy. Is there a type of fantasy you don't feel, like you mentioned gaming, that the things have to be defined very strictly in order to be fair in the game. But is there a type of, like, I kind of wonder, are there examples of, say, paranormal romance, what we're calling paranormal romance now, that used to be urban fantasy, that do the leaving things out in a way that the rest of the spectrum of fantasy does? You might think, maybe that was bad.
Well, I wanted to just throw one thing in that struck me when you were talking about the impact of gaming and you know, related to those things, what kind of genres are affected by this the most. I think there is sometimes some spillover between what the sort of game culture has created and what, you know, we as fantasy writers do. And it's sort of what I call the world-building sourcebook problem. It's when you create a book that would be a great sourcebook, and you could almost feel the statistics and the charts. You know, you're not allowed to write those because obviously people say, wait a minute, you're not writing a source book. But you come very close, you know what I mean? You can see the things sort of broken down. You can understand the famous, you can hear the dice rolling in the background as you read. And I think the problem is that there's an incredible inclination on the part of people. My first novel is epic fantasy, although most of the fantasy I write isn't. And I did, as all epic fantasy authors do, a lot of work in sort of building up before I actually wrote the book. I know the world, I know the nations and how they relate to each other, and the, you know, this person and this begat the other person, you know, and it reads something like something out of the Bible. You know, I mean, I know all the genealogies and all those sorts of things. But I think when you start including that information, right, as if you're making a gazetteer or an almanac or something instead of making an actual story, you've forgotten about, again, what made people interested in fantasy in the first place, and that is quite frankly not to sit down and read a documentary about some world they know nothing about. You know, people are interested in reading ultimately about story, and so you don't have to include every single detail, every bit of information, have lists of names front and back. I mean, you know, a map, that's fine. You need to have a map to be a fantasy. I would not commit the heresy of claiming you shouldn't have a map, but let's not overdo it here. And I think that there are a number of books that which are large enough that don't need to have additional information added to them in that regard. If you know it as a writer, the reader will, even through osmosis, get and understand much of it. And the second thing I'd say about that is, even the things that they don't get, they don't need to. Books function on different levels for different people with different readings. Where is it written that you need to understand everything about a particular world in the first read-through? When did that happen? Right? I'm on my 15th read-through, I think, of The Lord of the Rings, and I still see things there that I didn't see the first time when I was 10, reading it for the first time. Right? So this idea that we need to understand everything once, out of whole cloth, immediately, and that we can't let our work function on different levels, I think that's a problem, and I'm not convinced that that's because that's what readers or audiences want. In fact, I think that's probably not true. I think it's more the sense that we have gotten used to the idea that people want to spoon-feed all this information to us, and I'm not convinced that that's what readers and viewers want. If you look at a movie like Inception, for example, which was, I think, ambiguous, which does leave things out, and then you look at the critical success and the financial success, the commercial success of that movie, I think you see an audience out there which still does hunger to have some things left for them to do and not for us to do.
Yeah, I'd say you mentioned do we include the explanation, and I think the best advice is we don't include, we include. to use a term that I think Joe Williams coined, we include by building in clues into the narrative as to how things work, and then moving forward, moving on with the story. And if I understand the question, I hope I don't get off track here, but if I understand the question that's on the table right now, what other genres do we see this being used in? Because I was...
Was it used effectively... This is probably not a good question, because I was realizing that I had an example of a paranormal-type romance that was where it was used effectively, the leaving things out, but I realized later, okay, well, it's really closer to an urban fantasy. It's Rachel Caine's Weather Warden series. Where the further, you know, it starts out the first book, you kind of think you know the world, and the more it goes on, the wider the scope you get, and the more different things you find out about all the magic that's actually going on, and it just gets wider and wider as it goes out.
Yeah. So, and other examples of that, then, in other genres, are there other genres that...
Well, I was thinking specifically about... paranormal romance, which is kind of more of an offshoot, almost, of urban fantasy now. And those tend to be for the romance readers that don't want a lot of the world building. They want a very score specific. But then again, there's books like the Alana Andrews series, which who are categorized that way, but have very well developed worlds with very interesting magics and things like that that are expandable.
Sort of. Well, Diana Wynne Jones wrote a book called the Rough Guide. The Rough Guide to Fantasy, in which she set up a kind of fantasy which I think there is less of now, which took place in a medievaloid world, which was actually suburban America with pointy hats and long skirts, in which everything was very much what the writer was used to around them, but with much better clothes. And much more stew. there was no actual world building. It was this kind of, you know, painted backdrop against which the author worked out whatever it was that they were working out. And for a long time there were many, many, many of these on the market, but I think that as people have become a lot more conscious of world building, that now it's the pendulum has swung the other way,
so that you get these,
and you get these almost source books, where the world is really foregrounded, and the story and the people are backgrounded.
I was just going to say that the essay and also the characterization does not match the world. The people are living in a pre-technological world. Yet they never have trouble seeing at night. You know, there's the little candles, if you're seeing, like, even gaslight, it's very, you know, it doesn't put out lots of light, and nobody has any, everybody's raised with the scientific method and the Constitution and everything, and they think just the way we do. And there was a book, it was set in a sort of medieval-esque world that I tried to read, and there was actually a mystery where someone was killed in the village, and it was kind of interesting for a while, and then they were like, they started investigating it like CSI, you know, and they're like, well, we need to do this, and it was just like, and it's just kind of throwing you out. They're not going to look for forensic evidence. What are you saying? And there's things that have done it, like Sleepy Hollow is an example where Johnny Depp's character actually does have sort of primitive forensic evidence that he gathers, but it's all very done in a very, you know, 18th century way, and with that kind of equipment and that kind of thinking, where they're looking for the humors and they're trying to look at the person's eye to see if the image of the murderer is in the eye and that kind of thing. So there's good ways to do that, but yeah, the fantasy, the Tough Guide to Fantasyland, it really takes that aesthetic where you could literally take a search and replace code and make it you know, set in Chicago or whatever.
One of the things that I really like is books where what you don't know extends to the character, and it's not just the bad characters like Hannibal. Delia wrote down Emma Bull, and we were trying to remember the name of this book. It was a science fiction book in which the viewpoint character is of no particular gender, and
Bone
you don't...
Bone Dance.
Bone Dance. Thank you. Thank you. Oh, my God. have not had enough coffee yet. And part of the plot and the whole meaning of the book hangs off the extremely ambiguous nature of this character. But, of course, this character is just living a life and doesn't, you know, wonders about his, her, whatever, origin. Doesn't know anything about his, her origin, but is so deep inside his, her own mystery. And there's really got to be some sort of pronoun for this, but I'm not sure.
There.
Ooh.
Yeah. I know, but it's
no.
Shakespeare used it.
Yeah, but Shakespeare also, yeah, didn't have into plumbing. I mean, we should have moved beyond this.
This is your homework for next year. Come up with a pronoun for these things that we can all.
There will be a test.
Somebody needs to find one.
But the whole thing is that the plot of the book and the plot of the emotional arc of the book really depend on the nature of this character. And this character is curious about his, her own nature also. But most of the time it's like, you know, got to get something for breakfast. I have this job to do. Where's the bathroom? Yeah. They are living their lives, and it's the person, the reader, who really gets to have this journey with them.
I want to go ahead and open it up to questions and everything. I think you, I know, have been equipped in the black.
I was just going to say, you were talking about Hannibal, and you were also talking about, sorry, I didn't catch the name, but the Through a Dark Vapid Eye.
Yeah, Ruth Rendell.
What it made me think of is that there's still mystery in what's left out, but unlike the other fantasies and everything else where you don't know stuff about the world, the question is, what does it say about you? Lady and the Tiger, you know?
Yeah.
The whole point, you know everything in the story. You know, essentially, the question becomes one of yourself and your interaction. You're talking about, you've been drawn along with this serial killer, and it makes sense. What does it say about you? And so it seemed like that was...
Yeah, it's like, let's catalog his whole life in exhaustive detail.
That's a story where we're supposed to be along with the characters rather than about us. Does that make sense, or is that...
Yeah, I think so.
Yep. I don't say I'm right. I think that's
a valid point. So. Yeah. I think the man in the back with the orange cap was next.
Books that are most successful meet two conditions, and the really ultimately successful ones meet a third. The first condition is that, like an old-time radio theater show, I can picture it in my mind. The second is, nothing happens that takes me out of the story. You know, if the names start getting too many syllables, or I have to start looking up things, doesn't work. And the most ultimately successful ones are the ones that, to me anyway, are the ones that I can picture myself in one of the roles or at least somewhere around. And I realize that's the hardest challenge for authors to come up with.
Well, see, I think that's kind of a maybe more an individual thing because I never liked it. I read from the time, you know, I was very, very, very young, barely able to read. I was trying to read The Time Machine. But I never wanted to picture myself in the book. I like to be see other people. And that's kind of a point where they talk about kid characters. Like the problem with Wesley Crusher is they put him on there because the kids will identify with him, and the kids wanted to identify with the captain and the Klingon and all these other kids didn't want to see themselves in that situation as still a powerless kid. So I think that varies a lot.
It's not necessarily about a kid seeing myself as a kid, but if I can see myself.
Well, to identify with the character, to identify with the viewpoint character?
With some point of the story.
I think that bounces back to what Steve was saying. And what we want to see in fiction is elements of ourselves or elements that challenge ourselves. Elements that may be uncomfortable, we may be uncomfortable with, but we recognize them either as being part of us or part of what we could be, and also we see heroic characteristics that we wish we had, that we'd like to think we have. And so it's that two-way street with literature, and I think think you say it just right. The character doesn't have to be externally like me or in the same walk of life that I live in order for me to identify with that character. As a matter of fact, I really like to shy away from reading books that are from the point of view of writers. Because as far as I know, writers don't have particularly interesting lives. But I am interested in stories about accountants or missionaries. You know, people who may also have fairly well. I guess missionaries have exciting lives, but accountants. I don't know how exciting that is. Hopefully not. But there's something in their character. Vibrates, resonates with me, and it may be uncomfortable, it may be wish-fulfilling, but it's harmonic, and that's what I think. I do believe that third criteria is important in fiction as well. And
yeah, just very quickly, I'm also struck by, I think we've lost all the accountants, potentially, Ari, for this book report. I wanted to mention, too, that there are books in which that it part of the art is making the person uncomfortable because it's difficult to determine whom we should or should not identify with, right? So I'm thinking of a book like Gabriel Garcia Marquez's Chronicle of a Death Foretold, in which is much lesser known than his other work, and yet in some ways, given that he's constructing essentially, it's a murder mystery in essence, which begins with the murder. Immediately you know who's been killed at the very beginning. And much of the book is this narrator, who is incredibly unreliable, interviewing, well after the fact, I think it's almost 20 years later, people who were there at the time. And you don't discover, so first of all, unreliable narrator, 20 years later, people's memories become foggy. They contradict each other all the time. And what you don't find out until probably at least a third of the way into the book is that the narrator was also in the town at the time and saw this murder happen. He hasn't brought that fact up, which is rather important to know. And so then the question becomes, well, does this guy have an agenda? Do they have an agenda? How do we? And over time, it becomes like that thing which a famous sculptor once said when they asked him, well, how do you sculpt an elephant? And he said, well, I take a block of stone and I take away everything that isn't an elephant. Okay. and there's a part of us, I think, reading that book that feels the same way. We're determining everything that was, in fact, the murder by, in essence, finding out everything that wasn't. And we're only able to do that because we are never comfortably in or identifying with the mind of one character because we're always shifting from place to place. And that is, of course, an art, too.
Okay, yeah.
Give enough small revelations so that the audience feels satisfied. And you're dealing with millions of people who are going to have different levels of satisfaction, then you are going to lose it. And it's a really hard thing to do.
I'm trying to remember who was next. I think the man in the very back was next. I'm trying to take it in order of hands going up.
I was going to say that I believe that the thing that's more powerful is something that's in the book or movie that has given you anticipation of threat or promise. For me, a picture of a woman in a negligee looking negligee is a lot more exciting than the kind of classical photograph or puzzle or something.
Leaving to the imagination.
Yeah.
Okay, who was? Okay. Sorry, I was looking at this in the room.
I wanted you to address the issue of trust, if you could, because it's something I'm wrestling with.
Violating the reader's trust?
Trusting the reader, like the talented reader or viewer loves the subtle clues that they can pick up on that aren't too on the nose. And the flip side of that coin, perhaps the screenwriter, like sometimes Whedon, who writes things that are fairly subtle, but then those would fall flat on their face if you didn't have a talented actor who could put the performance in there to go along with this minimalist dialogue that wasn't on the nose.
Yeah, at least in a book you don't have to worry so much about that in production they'll screw it up.
I'd say that Henry James said that he will write for everybody, but he will put things into the book for 99% of the people who read the book, so they will feel closure and satisfied, and they will get it. But he will also be doing something in his books for the 1%, and in that 1% will see additional things that will make that work worthy of pondering or worthy of reading again. And so I think we have to write for both of those audiences. And that gets back to what I was saying about Hamlet, at the end of Hamlet. We feel satisfied on first viewing. Things have been wrapped up, and then it's only later that we realize that they haven't been wrapped up.
That's something that I really have to deal with because I'm writing middle grade books. And so they'll deal with a certain amount of ambiguity and mystery as long as there's something that is absolutely clear. So so if there are small questions that are answered along the way, if there is emotional satisfaction in the winding up, then there can be some mysteries that are left unexplained and remain mysterious along the way, and they will be delighted by them rather than frustrated by them. But you have to be very careful which ones they are, and it has to be important that they are mysterious. They have to create a certain emotional feeling that does not carry on to shadow the rest of the book, basically.
We've got 2 minutes till, so I think we're going to have to call it. Thank you all for coming.
Thanks.
And I know it's a difficult time of day. Thank you for still paying attention. I know a lot of you looked very sleepy. Kind of like a bell, so thank you.